let me take this opportunity to welcome both the minister and the deputy minister in our committee meeting. We really appreciate that. It shows the importance of the work that we're going to do. But all the members, just to remind ourselves, I don't know whether we should apologize. This meeting has been rescheduled more than 2 times. This is the 3rd time now. But one of the reasons were that as a committee, we took a decision that we don't want to see a bill being returned back to the NCOP because we did not follow all the processes. And we failed that to do a rush. There was one meeting that we postponed. We will not do justice to us. It may come back to us. But we are here today to consider 2 bills. One is a briefing, the other one is the finalization of the Refugees Amendment Bill. We'll start with that one today. In terms of apologies, I don't know if members have apologies. Marcel, do we have any apologies? Or Manturu?
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning. Good morning, everyone. I've just received an SMS, Chairperson, from Honorable Zan indicating that she'll be late for the meeting.
Okay, thank you very much. From the department, I think it's a full house. Thank you very much. I think we should continue with our meeting. In terms of item number 3, is the consideration of and finalization of the Refugees Amendment Bill, Bill 12B of 2016. If we could, Honorable Kaula and Honorable Kambo Kubana, remind ourselves where we started with the bill. In terms of the bill was referred on the 15th of March, 27 to us. We had a briefing in our committee on the 22nd of March, 2017. As required, we were expected to do public hearing. We had an advert on the 2nd of June, 2017, which was closing on the 16th of June, 2017. We did that in all 11 official languages so that we don't exclude any person. Then the department responded to issues that were raised on submissions emanating from the public hearings. Then our parliamentary legal advisors and the state law advisors make an input. Then in terms of 3.5, the committee deliberated on the issues. We are going to deliberate today, I'm sorry for that, on the issues that were presented or submitted by the public based on these issues. I will therefore invite the state law advisors. I don't know how they've organized themselves together with parliamentary legal advisors to lead us on the issues that we raised on the bill. As indicated before, I said we are politicians, not lawyers by profession. We depend on you. I want to repeat it again. We don't want to have a bill referred to us while all of you are here. I know also the legal people from the department are also here. So you cannot fail all of you to give us correct advice. But I must also indicate that to the committee that we also have a national treasurer represented today in this meeting. They had requested to do a presentation, but we indicated that is on the PMA. I just want you to know why they are here. But we said we'll consider that when we do the public hearings, not now. But also indicated that we are politicians who would want to see the minister taking a lead on that, not from the officials, unless he gives us in writing a go-ahead. But that relates to the second bill. I don't know how you are structured, who is going to start first in terms of taking us through the issues that were raised based on the public hearing. Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good morning, honourable members, ministers, deputy minister.
I'm not sure if you can hear me. May I please propose that the department take us through the submissions? They've prepared a document, and I've indicated to myself before the meeting that the department usually goes through the submission comments and then their response to that, and if there's legal issues that still need to be clarified, then we will clarify that. I'm not sure, I've not seen the parliamentary legal advisor here for the refugee amendment bill. But if it would be in order for us to perhaps proceed like that, because we didn't really prepare to do it the other way around.
Chair, Honourable Minister, Deputy Minister, and Honourable Members, no, we are ready, Chair, as you recall, that in the last meeting we did receive the responses, and then based on that we can be able to take the committee through our responses.
Okay, if we go that order, I will then request the Minister just to give us opening or some input on the bill before they get into the issues.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members. Firstly, I would really like to thank Honourable Members for affording us an opportunity today, given the importance of these pieces of legislation for us to ensure that we deliver on our mandate. Honourable Chairperson, before the Director General introduces the accompanying people and their positions quickly, I just wanted to say what I noted is that the people who made comments are people of good standing, the NGOs, powerful, well-known. So we were grateful when we stopped the process and said you need sufficient time to interrogate what they were coming up with. And I think the same applies to the department. They took some time and they interrogated the input. But of course, you will note as the DG presents that independent people, they will pick up an issue and not be conscious of any other related pieces of legislation in the system. So the department tries to help to draw to relevant pieces of legislation. But otherwise, the people who made input are highly respected, and we really appreciated their input. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. As we said, that is not for the first time we're coming here. We presented in the last time, so all the inputs now will be given by a legal, but also, Chair, there are amendments on our side as well, which we are proposing. So Dion will deal with both those responses and what we are proposing as amendments on the bill based on the inputs which we have received from the public. So with that, Chair, I will hand over to Dion Erasmus, who's the Chief Director.
Just raised now, what will be the implication? Because we're supposed to be finalizing now the bill and you are bringing some amendments. And the bill has been through to the portfolio committee, NDA is now here. What are the implications of that?
Thanks, Chairman. Good morning, Minister, Deputy Minister, Honourable Members. The implication there, because it's a Section 75 bill, obviously the NCOP has to look at it. If there are amendments suggested by the NCOP, it goes back to the Portfolio Committee and they look at the amendments and then they have the opportunity to engage in them, either accept them or not accept them at the end of the day. So it has to go back to the Portfolio Committee, but it doesn't come back from the Portfolio Committee to the NCOP again after that, to the Select Committee. It proceeds then after that to the House for final for determination. Thanks, Chair.
Can take us through. Do we all have hard copy?
Yes.
We do. So, okay, can you allow members to listen? Do we all have hard copies? Can we proceed with the presentation? Yeah. Is that the document you want to use? Okay. I think we can proceed.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, Honourable Members. What we've done as the department is to obviously look at the comments that were presented by the public following the publication of the bill for public comments. And in terms of the presentation, we briefed the committee on those, as well as proposed amendments that we would like to make based on some of the comments that we received. Some of them are technical amendments that we need to do. Others is consequential, etc. And there's one amendment that we have to do based on the comments that we did receive. That is, it's quite important. Chair, so if we move on slide 3, what we did is we looked at most of the comments that we received basically mirrored the comments that were received in the Portfolio Committee stages as well, and we received 13 submissions, which the Minister has already alluded to, being from reputable organisations, Legal Resources Centre, Scalabrini, UCT, etc. They mentioned there the 13 of them. So what the department then did is we looked at all of the clauses where there are comments on, and then we obviously gave our inputs as against what has been said there. Now, the first comment that we received that we all put together is, if you look at the long title of the bill, the comment that was made there was that the bill seeks to withdraw already granted refugee status. Obviously, our response to that is that the long title is a summary of the bill and of the proposed amendments. And as indeed indicated during the Portfolio Committee deliberations, there's nothing in the bill that seeks to withdraw the already granted status. So if a person is already a refugee, we're not withdrawing that. And remember, the long title of the bill is only there to see what we're wanting to do in the bill. So we're not withdrawing. It doesn't have retrospective effect. If we then move to Clause 1 of the bill, which deals with definitions, that amends Section 1 of the Act. One of the comments that we received there was to delete the word permit and to replace it with visa, and there were questions about that. And the clarity that we're providing is, remember, in terms of the amendments to the Immigration Act, we do not use the word permit anymore. It was amended to read visa. So obviously it's alignment with other pieces of legislation, more specifically the Immigration Act here. So, and then also there was an issue on the wording of dependent, and one of the issues that were raised there that was that a child, for instance, that's adopted, legally been adopted, would not be included under the definition. Now, our view in this regard is that the definition is obviously wide enough with the amendment there in order to include this. There was also an issue about education. What does dependent mean? And the department undertook to say, when we work with the communities, etc., there will be, and the other stakeholders, there will be education, public education in this regard for people to also understand it. But as currently the definition is defined, it suits the purposes. If we go to page 5, or slide 5, it's still on the definition of dependent, where I indicate that it excludes other family members, etc. What we've indicated, and it doesn't mention legally adopted children, etc. What we've indicated here, as the Minister has also alluded to, is that there are also other pieces of legislation that deals, like, for instance, the age of majority when people apply. That's your Children's Act. that deals with that. So what the department did is to also align the Refugees Act with other pieces of legislation that's already in operation that is applicable to all people that currently live in South Africa, whether it's a PR holder, whether it's a South African citizen, whether it's a refugee, whether it's an asylum seeker. Obviously, everybody has to comply with the rules and regulations and laws of South Africa. Another issue that was raised, Chair, was the issue of a spouse, and if there's a divorce, what would happen in this regard? What we've said there is that a spouse is an equal partner, obviously, in a marriage. So if there's a divorce, that spouse would be able to apply in own right as well. Even if there's death in the family, that spouse would be able to apply in own right as a refugee in the country. If we move to slide 6, Chairperson, Honourable Members, the definition of marriage, we also say, must be expanded. This is one of the comments that we received, to include marriages concluded in terms of Islamic or other religious rites. If you look at the definition of marriage, we're saying it's sufficient in the way it's been couched because it also covers marriages concluded in terms of foreign law. So if there's a country that acknowledges that specific marriage, we would acknowledge that. But it has to be concluded legally in terms of the foreign law. There's no specific legislation in South Africa that, for instance, acknowledges the Islamic, etc., marriages. Currently, as it is, we've got the Marriage Act, we've got the Recognition of Custody Marriages Act, etc., but not specifically for that. So what we're saying is any marriage concluded, legally concluded, in terms of the legislation of another country would be accepted. But obviously, there would have to be proof that it is legal and that it was legally concluded. Chair, that's as far as the definitions is concerned in terms of the bill that we had comments on. I can move to, that's clause one, and clause two of the bill that deals with the exclusionary provisions where people are excluded from refugee status. Now clause two amends section 4 of the Act. And what has been indicated in the responses is that it's unlawful to provide additional exclusionary clauses as envisioned in the proposed section 4.1e to I. Now these are additional clauses that we included, and it was said that we should not have done that. Our response in that regard is that obviously every person that's in the Republic is subject to the legislation that is operates in South Africa. So in other words, if the legislation is also applicable to South African citizens, PR holders, it should also be applicable to everybody that's in South Africa. You can't have one that's not applicable, and that's, as the Minister indicated as well, we need to have people that complies with the laws that are currently in South Africa. Obviously, if people commit fraud, it leads to contamination of the National Population Register, and that's got other knock-on effects, and we need to keep that clean, etc. It also impacts on the sovereignty of and security of South Africa as well, so we have to look at those issues. So obviously we're also saying that no one who wishes to apply for asylum has a need to obtain fraudulent documentation in order to do so. There is ways in which people can do that in a legal manner, and there are processes and procedures in place for people to allow them to be able to do that. So there's no necessity for fraud and stuff, and we need to address that. Chair, on slide 7, it's basically a repetition of what I indicated just earlier, where they said it's unlawful to provide the additional exclusionary clauses. What we're saying is obviously nobody is prevented from making an application to the department, and there's provision for this. Obviously, it has to be considered, and once it's considered, the decision will be made, etc. Now, what we're saying is a refugee can currently become a citizen of the Republic of South Africa, and as such has to be of sound and good character in this regard. So if a refugee can become a citizen by means of naturalization, there's a process that they go through. We want to have people also of good and sound character in South Africa. Chair, another issue that was raised here was the issue that we're changing the 14-day period of reporting to the refugee reception office to 5 days, and that this period is way too short. Now, what, Chair, this is one of the main amendments that we're doing that we'll suggest, and I'll explain how we're going to do it just now. The change from 14 days to 5 days, obviously, once again, as the Minister has indicated, is to align it with the Immigration Act. The Immigration Act already provides, in terms of Section 23 thereof, where they talk of your asylum seeker visa, your transit visa. So in other words, a person that comes to a port of entry, applies, one says wants to apply for asylum, that person is issued with a Section 23, what we call asylum transit visa, in order to report to the nearest refugee reception office. Now, even in the deliberations in the portfolio committee meeting, the issue about reporting and applying and the five-day period came about. So what we're saying is that people need to report to the nearest refugee reception office within 5 days. The application can happen maybe a bit late, but they'll be sorted within that, but they must reach the offices within that five-day period. And you'll see the amendment that we'll be suggesting as we go down. I've already indicated it's resulted in the amendment to Clause 2, which happened in the portfolio committee process, where we said the five-day period is for reporting purposes, so we're going to amend Clause or Section 15 or Clause 15 of the bill in order to align those two provisions. And I'll explain how we're going to do that just now. We'll come to that, Chair. Chair, on slide 8, we're talking about the cessation of refugee status, which is Clause 3 of the bill, amending Section 5 of the Act. And basically, the comments that we received there indicated that any powers granted to the minister relating to cessation of refugee status basically has to comply with your Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, which is Section 33 of the Constitution, which is a constitutionally mandated piece of legislation. We've looked at these comments, and obviously we indicate that the principles of natural justice will apply in this regard, and each and every case that is submitted will be determined on its own merits. Each and every case will be looked at. The department, obviously, we disagree with the argument that the voluntary reavailment, in other words, a person saying, I want to go back to my country, I'm voluntary reavailing myself, and that comes down to, that it's understood as a return to the country of nationality for or formal habitual residence with a view to permanently reside there. As soon as you indicate that I'm voluntary going back to my country, you're availing yourself, and it's not, it doesn't come back down to reforma. You voluntarily reavailing yourself, so you agreeing to that. Obviously, we're saying that there will be prescribed, under prescribed circumstances, this will happen. Now, where the minister will do this. Now, the prescribed circumstances, that will happen in the regulations. So in the regulations, one will make it clear as to what, how it will happen. The process will be set out there in the regulations. That's why we've got the words prescribed circumstances. Chair, if I may move to Clause 6 of the bill, which deals with the Refugee Reception Office. It's Section 8, the main Section 8 of the Act. So on Clauses 4 and 5, we didn't have any comments, so we're going to Clause 6. This deals with it, and it was said that the Director General's powers to disestablish a Refugee Reception Office should be made after consultation with relevant stakeholders. Now obviously, we've had cases in this regard as well. We're thinking of Scalabrini, we're thinking of the PE Refugee Reception Office. And in this regard, the courts have also found that this decision of the DG is polycentric in nature. That means that there are policy considerations involved here, and in view thereof, the Supreme Court of Appeal has also found that this is not subject to the provisions of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, this decision, because there's a whole lot of role players, etc., involved. This being the case, it doesn't mean that the DG can just take decisions as he or she wishes. Obviously, the principle of legality is just so that you see that what you're trying to do and what you want to achieve at the end, and the means you use in order to achieve the objective, is rational at the end of the day. And the courts can still, that can still be tested in the courts. So it's not that people are left without any remedy at the end of the day. They can still take it on review based on the principle of legality. Chairperson, if we turn to slide 9, the composition of the Refugee Appeals Authority, which is dealt with in Clause 7, which amends Section 8, Capital B of the Act, we're basically just noting that comment because it says that the inclusion of the legal qualification, remember we're saying that everybody in the RA must have legal qualifications, it's welcome, and they also believe it's necessary. So and it's also in line with the OAU Refugee Conventions, the 1951 Refugee Convention, etc. Turning to Clause 9 of the bill, Chairperson, which deals with the term of office of the Refugee Appeals Authority, which amends Section 8, Capital D. What's been indicated there, one of the things is that it's unclear what would happen once the minister has removed the member from the RAB from office. Now, what we're indicating here, that the person that with these comments that were made in this specific regard, that's dealt with in Clause Section 8D, not 8B of the bill. So we're saying that the provision in Clause 9 dealing with Section 8B is not related to the removal of members of the RA, but the term of office of the members of the RAA. So they just had an incorrect difference there. Yeah. Chair, if we turn to slide 10, which deals with the removal from office of members of the Refugee Appeals Authority, which is the one I just discussed. This, you noted that the people used it incorrectly there. It's clause 11 of the bill, and it amends section 8, capital F of the Act. What's been indicated there is that the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs is currently overburdened with reviews, and it's taking lengthy periods and time to review RSEO decisions, etc., and that we must be very cautious about adding more unnecessary administrative burden to the SCRA. A further one is that the DHA cannot, that's been indicated, that we cannot legally restrict or regulate the right to work in or study in this regard. So our response in, here is to say that the functions that are given to the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, they currently exist in the Principal Act, so they've always been there. They're not additional in this sense. We've also indicated in the Portfolio Committee that the exercising of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs' powers to determine work and study conditions, what SCRA must do when they do that, they must take into consideration circumstances of the applicant, and it must be on a case-by-case basis. And you see, as I jump later on, this is where the Wachinuka case is mentioned a lot of times. Now, we've studied the Wachinuka case, and in terms of Wachinuka, the court made it very clear that the applicant, which was the mother and her son, should be allowed to work and the son study in order to sustain themselves in that specific circumstances that they were finding themselves. They were already here for 6 months, 7 months in the country. But the court also said that you need to look at this on a case-by-case basis. It's not a blanket approval. So what happened at the end of the day is that the Wachinuka case was taken and it was implemented on a blanket, using a blanket approach. So whenever you issued a Section 22 asylum visa, what then happened is work and study was also included as a matter of fact on that specific, and we just bringing it in line with Wachinuka as to what Wachinuka really said. Each case has to be looked at on its own merits, looking at the specific circumstances of the individual in the specific instance. Chair, if we look on slide 11, moving to clause 12, which deals with the filling of the vacancies in the Refugee Appeals Authority. So I've already touched on Wachinuka. You can see it on the next page there, et cetera, where we indicate. Now, what was said to us is that Section 8G of the Act, as inserted by Section 11 of the Amendment Act, has provided for the filling of vacancies which arise in the RAA as a result of death, resignation, or removal from office. They say we're not replacing this. And what we're saying is that Section 8B, capital B, that is in the Act currently provides for, and how, why do we say that? Because Section 8B allows the Minister to appoint members of the Refugee Appeals Authority for 6 months or 3 months, depending on the work there. So even if there is a vacancy that arises, the Minister will be able to appoint, etc. So it's already dealt with and catered for under the provisions of Section 8, capital B. Chair, turning to the functions of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs, which is dealt with in Clause 13. Now, Clause 13 amends Section 9, capital C of the Bill, or the Act. It was indicated in submissions that we received that there must be careful reconsideration regarding the functions of the Standing Committee. There appears to be no obligation on the Standing Committee to monitor or review any other decision taken by the RSEOs. And they say that the clause does not provide enough checks and balances on the decision-making power of the RSEO. And the response of that we indicate is to say the Standing is empowered to do quality assurances provided for, if you look at Clause 13, where the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs will look at RSEO decisions. If they are found to be faulty, they'll be reverted back, they can give advice in this regard, etc. So we have the view that there are enough checks and balances in place in order to safeguard risks that we could run into at the end of the day. A further comment that was made was that there's an onus that's placed on the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs to determine the period of conditions in terms of which asylum seekers may work or study, and that this is an unnecessary administrative burden. I've already alluded to this. We're just basically aligning what we're saying, what was said in Wachinuka, just doing in the piece of legislation as well, so that the Standing Committee can look at that. This has always been a function of the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs. It's not a new thing. It's always been there. Chair, further thing was entered that submitted that in order to circumvent the situation, what they want to do is that Section 9C1C of the Act has to make provision that all decisions by the RSDO have to be monitored and supervised. This is precisely what the Standing Committee for Refugee Affairs is empowered to do now. They would do quality assurance, and this is also dealt with in Clause 13 that I've already alluded to. They'll monitor and supervise all decisions taken by your refugee status determination officers. So there would thus be sufficient checks and balances in this regard. It was also indicated the functions of SCRA regarding its obligation to determine applications for certification of permanent residence has been omitted. That is an incorrect statement. There is no omission. The said issue is dealt with in Clause 23, in which we amend Section 27 of the Act. So it is provided for in the Act. It has not been omitted. If we turn to crime prevention and integrity measures, which is Clause 14 of the Bill, which is a new Section 20 capital A that's being inserted in the Bill. So this is where they're going to be integrity measures, people have to be vetted, etc. The comments that we received in this regard is that attempts made by the DHA to combat corruption and asylum application process, it's admirable. So the people say it's a good suggestion. But it's submitted that no provision is made for reporting of corruption. It's submitted that an internal corruption reporting measure should be considered by the DHA. Now, in the department, we've got your counter-corruption security branch that deals with it. There's internal hotlines. There is numerous mechanisms and processes and procedures in place in terms of which people can indicate where corruption is taking place, etc., in order for it to be dealt with.
We were told that there was a swipe of venues because the other committee needed more chairs. We are experienced exactly the problem why they wanted the other venue that was originally booked for us. It was not the right decision. Are we getting chairs for all of them? Okay, let's proceed.
Thanks, Honourable Chairperson. On clause four, on slide 14 of the presentation, dealing with application for asylum, which is dealt with in clause 15 of the bill, which amends section 21 of the Act, it was indicated that blanketly rejecting any application with false information was indicated to us is problematic to do that. And we've noted those comments, and we've looked at clause 15, and we obviously looked at also the guidelines of the UNHCR. If you look at page 40 of the handbook, it enjoins applicants to be honest and establish fully the merits of their application. So obviously, we would want them to provide correct information when they do the application. There's no need, as I indicated earlier as well, for people to provide false information, etc., so that we know which applicants we're dealing with. If you look at the power of the DG to dictate that categories of asylum seekers report to designated officers, it was indicated that would effectively amount to a barrier to the asylum seekers. We're saying that this is a discretionary power of the DG. And obviously this discretion has to be exercised against numerous things that has to be taken into consideration before finally deciding something. A variety of issues would have to be taken into consideration, in fact, such as resources, where there's a possible influx of asylum seekers in the country, etc. And in order to do a proper administration of the Act, the Director General has to be placed in such a position that he or she would be placed in a position to take such a decision whenever the need arises. Now, the only way in which to do that is to have an enabling provision in your legislation to do that, and that is the reason why it is there. Obviously, as I've indicated earlier, if this decision, there's a decision by the DG and people are aggrieved, there are other remedies available to them. You can look at your Promotion of Administrative Justice Act, where people can take the matter on review. You've also got your principle of legality, where people can say, based on the decision, was it a rational decision, and whether or not that would stand the test, or it can also be taken on review. Chairperson, if you go to slide 15 of the presentation, it was also said that there's agreement with the department that every applicant for asylum ought to submit his or her biometrics at the port of entry. So people on agreement, one of the things in the bill is saying that they need to provide their biometrics at the port of entry. We note this comment. There was a further comment to say that the requirement that only certain categories of asylum applicants will be assisted at a given office, that this serves to discriminate against all other categories. This then basically relates back to the issue of the 5-day period for reporting and not application at the end of the day. And as I will go further, I'll explain why we're saying that, because if a person reports to the refugee reception office, doesn't mean an application has been submitted. So if he or she should fall outside the 5-day period, if there is when we need interpreters for a specific day, or there's a specific nationality that comes on a specific day, you will not be excluded from applying for your refugee status. You will be assisted. So that's why that amendment is so important. The issue about the 5-day period, it said here that an applicant who is unable to apply within 5 days would be excluded from the refugee regime. As I've just indicated, that's the reason for the amendment that we're proposing. That person will not be excluded, and it will just give a mechanism in order to deal with that person, to register that person, and the application can happen on a later date after the 5-day period so that they're not excluded. And obviously you also don't want individuals to be in the country without any formal identification, etc., in terms of your Refugees Act, etc. So this is something they will be handed with documentation in this regard to indicate that they are legally in South Africa. As I've indicated there on slide 16, Chairperson, this is where we're suggesting the amendment, and I will get to that when we get to the end of the, where we're aligning the 5-day period in clause 15 of the bill, to say how we're going to deal with that. And I'll explain to the committee in terms of our C list that we've prepared, how that will be worded. Is that in order with Chair? We'll follow that with thanks. Chair, on clause, slide 17, we deal with the spouse and dependent of asylum seekers and refugees, which is clause 17 of the bill amending section 21B. Basically, there was just agreement in the Commons of the department that dependents ought to have the same visa as the principal applicant. And obviously, when dependency ceases, the person may apply in the prescribed manner to be permitted to continue to remain in the Republic. So this is where the issue of where you can apply in own right, etc. And we just note that comment because people are agreeing with that vision. The asylum seeker visa, that your second 22 visa that's issued, it's clause 18 of the bill, which amends section 22 of the Act. Once again, Chen, I don't want to belabor the point. It's the Wachinuka case that was mentioned, and it says that granted asylum seekers the right to work and study as an adjunct to their right to dignity. What we're saying is, what we're doing in the Refugees Amendment Bill is to align what was said in Wachinuka, to align the bill with the intention of Wachinuka, because Wachinuka made it very clear that each and every case needs to be decided on an individual basis, looking at its own circumstances. There should not be a blanket approach in granting a right to work and study. What we've also done, Chair, and it's mentioned, the department also adjusted this provision during the deliberations before the Portfolio Committee, because there were concerns raised regarding the amendment to Section 22.8b. And what we did there is, after the words UNHCR, we stopped there, but we said if there are any other charitable organizations or person that can assist a refugee or asylum seeker in this regard, those people will also be approached. So it's not only the UNHCR, because there are other entities as well that could provide assistance in this regard. Chair, if we turn to slide 18, which is clause 19, which amends section 23 of the Act, it deals with the detention of asylum seekers. It said that the section provides that the Director General may withdraw an asylum seeker, yet further provides that he or she may cause the holder to be arrested and detained pending the finalization. What we've indicated here is that the proposed amendment is of a technical nature. It's once again changing the word permit to visa. the one thing. And the other thing is the provision has always been there. It's not something that we're bringing in that's new now. It's always been in your Refugees Act. If we look at Clause 23, which amends Section 27 of the Act, which deals with the protection and general rights of refugees, it was indicated that people were saddened by the extension of the number of years in which a refugee may be considered for permanent residence. Applying for and acquiring permanent residence is a step closer to calling the country a second home. What we've indicated there as well, and these were also discussions in the Portfolio Committee deliberations, the proposed period of 10 years is in order. No person's granted refugee status will be in limbo, and I think that is the major thing. Nobody's in limbo as they have refugee status. And as a person, if you have refugee status, you've got all the rights in terms of the Constitution except the right to vote. All the other rights you have, you're not excluded from any other. You are covered except in terms of the right to vote. Now, obviously, if a person obtains PR, permanent residence, from there there's naturalization that takes place, and then from there there's the issue of citizenship. But the person won't be in limbo, so the period in and out is correct. Chair, if we turn to slide 19, removal and detention of asylum refugees and asylum seekers, that's clause 24, which deals with section 28. It was indicated that section 28.1, that's to be inserted, it must be in line once again with section 33.1 of the Constitution. Now, section 33.1 of the Constitution is that basically indicates that all your process must be fair, etc. It's your PAJA, Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And what we're basically saying there, obviously every decision that's made in that regard, the principles of PAJA would apply, as well as the principle of legality, where your rationality test will come in. If we look at clause 27 of the bill, Chairperson, amending section 36 of the Act, which deals with your withdrawal of refugee status, the indication there was that section 36.3, that the department must assure that the implementation of cessation is done in a manner that also complies with the regulations and the guidelines set out by the UNHCR. We've noted these comments, and furthermore, we're also saying that this amendment, if you go and look at that specific section, it is subject to PAJA. PAJA will in any case apply, but the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act is specifically written in there, so it has to apply with administrative justice at the end of the day. So judicial review obviously is possible in this regard. There was also a comment to the effect that provisions of the section departs from those contained in what we call Regulation 17 of the regulations that were made under the Refugees Act. Now, what we wish to indicate here is that regulations are subordinate legislation. So obviously, and it cannot override an act or a specific section in the Act of Parliament. So if it does that, it is ultra vires. What we would do, obviously, one would look at the regulations. If there are need for amendments to regulations, one would do that. But that is a process that will only happen after the finalization of this bill, once it's enacted as an Act of Parliament, following the sending and signature by the President. Chair, another concern that was raised in this regard, is that's on slide 21, is that the inevitable consequence which will flow from the withdrawal of refugee status is the expulsion of an individual from the Republic. That's not just, it doesn't just happen now. There's a lot of processes and procedures that are in place, administrative procedures that are in place before a person would reach that stage. Obviously, if you've gone through all the processes, there's CRA, there's the Refugee Appeals Authority, there's your judicial reviews that you can bring to court, etc. So those are all internal processes and remedies that you have at your disposal before. So once we've gone through all of that and the person is still found to be, and one will be dealt with as an illegal foreign in terms of the Immigration Act, and obviously then the provisions of the Immigration Act will kick in. Then there were a few general comments around, but all the general comments were all over the show, but it dealt with precisely the same issues that we've highlighted here and that we've already spoke to Chairperson. Chair, if I may turn to the suggested amendments based on the inputs that we received and what we would suggest and what we picked up when we went through the bill again, which would be, we call technical or consequential amendments. If may I proceed with that? Thanks, Chairperson. Chair, what we're indicating, I don't know, it's going to be a bit technical, but it's on the bill itself now, and if I can go to... It's on page 4 of the bill.
which deals with clause 4.
Chair, what we've also done is we've already... We've also prepared a C list already that is also that should form part of the pack where we, the reason why I just want to use both is to take the members to the specific area in the bill as well together with a C list so that they read together. On page 4 of the bill, so it's page 1 of the C list document, this one that we have members. What we're suggesting there in the bill, if you look on line 44, the one is where we say proposed committee amendments to the Refugees Amendment Bill. It's what we call the C list. This is the one document. It was also sent through. It was. Okay. Okay. All right. Now I just wanted to make sure because we did send it through. Sorry. Thanks, Chairperson. So what we're saying on page 4, so if we look at the on page 4 in line 44, these are the amendments we're proposing, yeah, in this, yeah, that we're proposing now. Now, the Chair, how it works is the B bill, this bill, there were amendments in the Portfolio Committee, those were agreed to, etc. The Portfolio Committee then effected those amendments, and that bill was agreed to by the Portfolio Committee before it was sent through. So the bill that the chairperson is sitting on this committee is seized with is the bill that already incorporates amendments by the Portfolio Committee. Yeah. So this is, these are new. That's right. But it's based on the B bill that comes from the Portfolio Committee version. Thanks, Chairperson. So we're saying on page 4, in line 44, let me look on the right-hand side of the bill. If you go to line 44, you see in the beginning of that line, it says 9 capital B, and then there's a bracket 1, close bracket 1. That 1 shouldn't be there. So we're saying on page 494 to omit that 1. It's just an incorrect crossword that we're fixing. So it's a technical amendment that has to be corrected. So we're just amending that one. Chair, then we can move to page 9 of the bill. Which deals with clause 15. As explained during the presentations, honourable members, the issue about the reporting to the nearest refugee reception office within 5 days was also something that was mentioned in the portfolio committee stages. So what we're saying, if one reads, let me look at line 5. I'm going to read that subsection 1. It says, an application for asylum must be made in person in accordance with the prescribed procedure within 5 days of entry into the Republic. So it says the application has to be made within 5 days, and that's what we need to correct. It's the reporting that must happen within 5 days. So what we've done in this regard, Chair, is to say that we'll have a 1 brackets A, a new paragraph A that we'll insert there, which would read as follows. Upon reporting to the refugee reception office within 5 days of entry into the Republic, an asylum seeker must be assisted by an officer designated to receive asylum seekers. So that's the first process. Then we've got B, the current one that's there. We're using that kind of, with a few amendments here, we're using as B, which will then say an application for asylum. Now we're dealing with the application process. Must be made in person in accordance with the prescribed procedures to a refugee, and we're taking out the within 5 days there because we've already dealt with that in terms of the reporting to a refugee status determination officer at any refugee reception office or at any other place designated by the DG by notice in the Gazette. And that would also align with the amendments to Clause 2, etc. But so then there's alignment between the pieces of legislation. Chair, the next amendment that we have is on Clause 17, which is page 10 of the bill. Yeah, in line 7 on that bill, there's the word says asylum have the same status as accorded. Now, I might stand to be correct, but that word has to be has. If you look at any child of an asylum seeker born in the Republic and any person included as a dependent of asylum in the application for them has the same status. So it's just it's a technical amendment. Nothing much turns on it. Chair, the next amendment is to Clause 18 of the bill. It's on that same page, page 10. If we look in line 38, it deals with subsection 5, 22.5. The Director General may at any time withdraw an asylum seeker visa in the prescribed manner if. But what needs to happen there is we need to deal with the situation where you issued with an asylum seeker visa. Now there's a period within it's issued within which that asylum seeker visa is issued. So what we want to say is that the Director General may at any time prior to the expiry of an asylum seeker visa withdraw such visa in the prescribed manner. So what we're saying is that if in that validity period a person falls foul of any of these specific provisions, the DG must have the power to withdraw that because no such power has been given in terms of the legislation. So in view thereof, and what we're indicating is that to say the Director General may at any time, and then between the words time and withdraw, we'll say prior to the expiry of an asylum seeker visa, we'll include that there, and then you'll say withdraw, and then the words an asylum seeker visa or an asylum seeker visa will be deleted and it will be replaced just with the word such because it refers back to that visa. Can I repeat that again? Sure. If you look on page 10, subsection 5, how it would read after the amendments, it would say the Director General may at any time, and then we're including the words prior to the expiry of an asylum seeker visa. Okay? And then the word withdraw would remain. And after the word withdraw, we delete the words an asylum seeker. Just an asylum seeker. And we'll just replace that word with such. So you say such visa. It just refers back to that. So just replacing the word. Chair, the next amendment that we have is also on the same page in line 47. It deals with subsection 6. Now it reads currently as an asylum seeker may be assessed to determine his or her ability to sustain himself or herself and his or her dependents with the assistance of family or friends. The only thing that we're saying there is it should be with or without the assistance, because you would have instances where an asylum seeker would be able to assist himself, not necessarily with the need of friends or family. So it's just a very technical thing that we just to say, whether with or without the assistance of your family, if you can sustain yourself, we'll take that into consideration. So in order to achieve that specific objective, what we're saying there is that after, if it is herself, that's in line 47, and his or her dependents, and then we will include the word either. So it'll be his or her dependents either, and then we leave the word with, and then we also include the words or without the assistance of family or friends. Chairperson, then we can move to page 12 of the bill, which deals with clause 21. And there in line 36, it deals with subsection 4, so 24A, capital A, sub 4. It says currently that the standing committee must inform the refugee status determination officer at the refugee reception office. Now you've got a few refugee status determination officers at a refugee reception office. So what the standing committee needs to do, they need to inform the refugee status or the refugee reception office of the outcome. Not the RSDO, because there are many. So we're just basically saying, in view thereof, we're saying that the standing committee must inform, and and then we delete the words refugee status determination officer at the. We're just deleting that, so it would read, the standing committee must inform the refugee reception office where the application for asylum was lodged of its decision within 5 working days. Yeah, refugee status determination officer at the. You delete those, and your refugee reception office remains. Then with regard, the next amendment that we suggest, Chair, is on clause 32. It's a technical or consequential amendment that we have. If you look at clause 32, which appears on page 15 of the bill, we're indicating there, you see the heading there in line 4, substitution of phrases. But if you look at 32B, it says permit. A permit is a word. Whereas if you look at A, that paragraph A, asylum seeker permit is a few words, that's a phrase. So very technical, we're just saying that what we should do in line 4 is to insert the word words or after, so it will read substitution of words or phrases. We just include the word words or after of in the heading. And then in line 5, we say that the principal act is hereby amended by the substitution for the word or phrase. So we just include the word word or. And then if you go to paragraph B, which reads permit in relation to an asylum seeker wherever it occurs of the, and then we're replacing that word phrase with a word word. Because permit is a word, it's not a phrase. It's only one comma. No, we're taking out phrase, and in the place of phrase, you're putting the word word. So it will read permit in relation to an asylum seeker permit wherever it occurs of the word visa, not the phrase visa.
Just thinking of what you presented earlier, where you replace permit with visa. So now I'm trying to understand what you are saying here.
What we do is, remember, when we come to substitution of words and phrases in the bill itself, there might be other places where the word or visa and permit appears, but there's no amendment to that specific section in this bill. So what we do is, in terms of legislative drafting, you deal with it under substitutional. So wherever in the bill that appears, that might not have been dealt with, it would be covered under this specific section. So that's how we do the drafting in that specific instance. Because there might be sections where there's a visa or the word permit appears once or whatever, and it, by using this specific section, you would replace that thing. You don't have to do each and every specific section. Jen, then obviously, it's not been indicated here because you don't do it in a C list. Obviously, what we'll do is, based on these proposed amendments that we have, we'll also look at the objects on the memo of the bill and align them with these amendments. Like, for instance, on page 16 of the bill, if you look at the second last line under purpose of bill, the line starts there with of refugees, semicolon, to provide for additional offences and penalties, semicolon, and what we'll add there is just to provide for transitional provisions. That was, because if you look, even if the long time, transitional provisions has to be included there. On it's page 16. Yeah, there's no line in your memorandum on the object. That's what I'm saying, it doesn't form part of you, but it's just something. If you look at the second last line there, the line starts with of refugees, semicolon, to provide for additional offences and penalties, semicolon, and then we want to add the word to provide for transitional provisions. It will just be inserted there between that and the word and, just to align that. Chair, then on page 18 of the memo, It's just the word that we've already dealt with that in the bill as well, where the word have has been changed to the word has. If you look at paragraph 2.17, the third line in the Republic, and any person who has been included. Just change that. So all the other amendments that we make is just to align it with, well, there's I think one or two others, but it's just alignment that we're doing. Thanks, Chair. That's the presentation. Thank you very much.
Taking us back to the classroom. Okay, no, thank you very much for the presentation. DG, would you want to say something? DM, would you want to say something before I give the state law? State law advisors and parliamentary legal team, legal advisors.
Thank you, Chair.
On these matters that were raised by the organizations or NGOs as part of their submissions and the responses of the department, what is your take? I don't want to say do you agree or not. What is your take?
Chairperson, I actually went through our comments that we made on their comments as well. And it's very similar. Most of the concerns are actually policy-based concerns. But then many of the concerns were regarding the application of the Promotion of Administrative Justice Act. And we found those concerns to be unfounded because actually all of the decisions taken in terms of the Act is subject to the budget. So I kept on repeating myself in my comments as well about the fact that the PAJA is brought into this this amendment bill and into the Act by implication because it's a constitutional act. And then also we agree with the department on the application of the Wachanuka case also that came out in the portfolio committee where the right to work was concerned. So every matter must be dealt with on a case-by-case basis. That comes out very clearly in the case. And we feel that it finds application also in this bill. And as to the amendments, we have sat with the department on the amendments and we agreed with them because they were informed by some of the technical drafting issues that we had to reconsider and then also the matter of the 5 days that was actually clear that it should have rather been you should report within 5 days instead of application within 5 days. And actually there were many concerns also raised in some of the comments from the public on that. So we also agree with the amendments. Thank you, Chair.
Parliamentary legal advisors.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, my apologies on behalf of Mr. Njekane. He is the legal advisor who is dealing with the Refugees Amendment Bill. He has indicated to me that he has gone through the amendment and he has spoken with the department and the state law advisors and he's in agreement with the amendments. He did do his work beforehand. Unfortunately, he's unable to attend because he has an urgent matter to deal with.
All right, members, can we interact with the presentations? Just to remind ourselves that even after the closing date, looking at the interest of the public, we agree that we will take all submissions. I was confirming with the Secretariat, they did take all submissions, so we considered almost everything. Opening now to members to interact with the presentations on the submissions by the public. Anything we want to raise before we go to a voting. I have Honorable Kawula, Honorable Nguyenyam, Honorable Hutton. Those are the hands I have now.
Thanks, Chair. These law people are limiting our participation. They all agree with one another. Chairperson, I just want to find out, for clarity purposes, what happens to an asylum seeker who within 5 days fails to report themselves for valid reasons.
Thank you, Chair. Also, just for clarity, perhaps I've missed it. It's about the biometrics. Do I understand that the biometrics issue is obligatory? It will be done. Thanks. And it's then that's it.
The length of time it takes for the visa from the time of application until it is completely processed, how long does it take? Because I heard the number of days that the presence of a person should be reported within 5 days, but what about the duration of processing the application for the asylum seeker? Another issue, as I was looking at the submissions, I was looking at the submission of the Center for Constitutional Rights and the South African Human Rights Commission. I just want to get to know whether from your presentation you did consider some of their suggestions. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. From my side, the first one is on the, just to add to Honorable Paula's input, what will be recognized as valid reason? What will be, and what measure do you use to say this is a valid reason? The second matter is on the you are saying you are taking into consideration that there are other laws or acts that speaks to these certain matters. So you are of the view that this is not the only act. It has to be recognized, what also the minister was saying. My question is that those asylum seekers, do they know those? Talking about an ordinary person, do they know those laws, or are they assisted by legal people, or it just it's taken for granted that they will be assisted? Do they know these other laws that you are taking for granted that there are other laws that are talking to that? The other matter is on the Islamic marriages. You're saying there is no South African, there is no law, South African law, that recognizes Islamic marriages. Then what happens? Because you're saying in other countries, any other marriage that is legally recognized by other countries, can you explain the Islamic marriages in this context? What will happen? When we visited the Sindela, one of the issues that we're told is that, I'm taking from what you said, when a person voluntarily wants to go back. When we were there, we were told that there is a trick that they do, that every December they get themselves arrested, so that they will be taken free back to their countries. But after December they come back again. in this particular instance, are there similar cases? Just because they want to go back home, now they surrender themselves to go back to their country. But of course, we take it for when on the issue of the long period of 10 years, we take it that people like their countries, they would want to stay in their countries. They only come here because there are problems in their countries. So I'm just making a statement, not a question, to say this period shouldn't be a big problem for me, because if things were right in their countries, they would want to go back. So I'm just making that statement. But those are the issues from my side. Can we have my responses?
Chair, I'll respond to some, and I'll also ask the colleagues that are with me here to respond on certain of the matters. Chairperson, with regard to the first question, Honourable Kolo, the issue of 5 days, if a person fails to report within 5 days, there are procedures that have been set in place in the specific legislation, the amendment bill. So if a person would come there and he or she has not reported within the five-day period, there's a process where the inspectorate is also involved doing an investigation. Why was the person not able to attend to the refugee reception office within 5 days, etc., so that you don't sit with a situation that the person, it's open-ended and people decide that they can come whenever they want to. So the five-day period, there are checks and balances in place if a person does not rock up within 5 days. So obviously it will be in the discretion of that specific inspectorate official when they hear and listen to the reasons, but once again, once the reasons are there, what would happen, it would be subject to certain reviews, etc., that can also take place.
To the clause in question on page 3 of the bill, right at the bottom there is Roman I. You'll see there that it says where the person has failed to report to the reception office within 5 days of entry into the Republic as contemplated in section 21, in the absence of compelling reasons, which may include hospitalization, institutionalization, or any other compelling reason. So these are some of the reasons that will be acceptable for you to provide as a reason why you could not come within 5 days. So it's not completely discretionary. It's guided by the legislation as to what would be the reasons that would be acceptable.
Just on that, just to check, is this any other compelling reasons to open? Because it goes back to my question, isn't it? Because if you say any other, it could be compelling to any reason, could be compelling to any person. Is it not too open?
Chair, we had considered having a closed list. And the portfolio committee, if I recall correctly, was not too happy with that. And they said, what if we have not thought of some reason that may be compelling in those circumstances? They were raising all manner of issues such as funerals, if you recall correctly, and so on, that people had. I don't think that a funeral is compelling reason in any case, but clearly they were uncomfortable with a closed list, which is why we've put it here. What we may try and do is to see if we can't find further compelling reasons and put that in the regulation. But beyond institutionalization and hospitalization, I really can't think of anything. If somebody meets up in an accident and is hospitalized, that's a good reason. If somebody has been arrested before they arrive at the refugee reception center, that's a good reason for me. I can't, for the life of me, think of any other reason.
Yeah, as we said, that we did discuss this, but somebody will come and say, what if this person is kidnapped and a case has been reported that this person was kidnapped? It can be something that, as I'm saying, one can look at if there is a proof like that, but I can't just come and say I was kidnapped. I just ended up.
So those are the, as we said, that that's why the committee felt that maybe rather than closing it, maybe we leave it like that. But once again, at least we start with at least institutionalized or secure something at that level, which will be able to have some sort of a proof. Not that I just come here and says, no, I was kidnapped, says no, but if I was kidnapped, if there's a case, what kind of police and they're investigating that? And yes, in those days, who were there? And it's something which made one can.
The more you explain, the more I identify loopholes. Because for me, okay, anything is possible. You know, people can kidnap themselves for this reason. I'm not saying they can do that, but anything is possible. I just want to check if we can add the word, there must be a proof for that, because it's not TN now. TN.
Perhaps what we should do is, it's a bit difficult in law to say if there's proof, but what we can do is to say as prescribed, and then require in the regulations that there must be some overt proof of such compelling reasons. I think that would be doable.
Right, let's proceed.
I mean, within the same clause as that Deputy Minister referred to, you'll see that the word compelling is used twice, which really, it means the intentions of the drafters are really restricting. It's used twice, it's line number, that's HI 1, 2, 3, and 4, line 3 and 4, there. Yeah, so, has it been closed all out or I press it? No, I was just saying, Chairperson, Honourable Members, that the very same clause that the Deputy Minister referred to, the word compelling is used twice, which clearly sent a clear message that that's the emphasis, is the importance of the reason why you didn't present yourself to apply. It should really be compelling, in which means any other person looking at your case should be convinced that the any other reasonable person in the similar circumstance, let's say you broke your leg, you couldn't walk, whatever, could be in the could have not done it. But also I wanted to say, Chair, I think it's important to, I agree with the drafters that this 5-day period is very, very important, given the situation we're in, where everybody wants an asylum seeker status of some kind. If we're to just increase the number of days before they apply, we enhance the risk of some people disappearing into societies and many other things that open us to risks of not managing these asylum seekers, even in this category of refugees, tightly. Because even economic asylum seekers, sometimes they do resort to an application for a refugee status. So the tighter it is within the first 5 days, the better for us.
Okay. Have you responded to all questions? I don't think so. I just want to add one, where they cannot feed themselves altogether. I'm just adding that it was not there. It's spoke about relatives or without relatives, where they cannot feed themselves all together, what happens? Can we proceed with responses?
What is the longest possible period that a refugee status can be accorded? No, I asked that one, this one, I just want to know, when you are given a refugee status, how long can it be in terms of the law? Because it cannot be ad infinitum.
He said the members, colleagues, will assist him in responding. Where are the colleagues? I check the state law and the other team will also assist.
Good morning, Chairperson, Minister, Deputy Minister, and the members of the committee. We were hoping that we allow the presenter to cover all these questions before we come in so that we don't go back and forth. That's why we did not move with speed. However, I will address a couple of questions related to operations that were raised there. The question that relates to what happens after the 5 days of reporting and how long does it take for the process to finalize the asylum application. It is provided for that we should, as the department, having finalized the asylum application within 90 days. In that period, we break it down depending on the outcome of the first adjudication of the asylum, which once the adjudication is done and we found that the decision is unfounded, we allow the applicant to submit the appeal and we give the applicant 30 days to do so. And after 30 days, then the case will be referred to one of the statutory bodies, which is the appeal board, to look at the representation and consider the date for the hearing. It is expected that that should be finalized within that 90-day report. Even then, the challenge is around the number of members within the appeal board that can exceed the 90 days. But we are hoping with these amendments that we will be able to remain within 90 days. For cases related to review, once the decision is taken by the RLTOs, we expect after 14 days to issue the decision by the standing committee, and after that the person is allowed to take that decision if feels aggrieved to the judicial review. So maximum, we expect those two routes of the decision in particular to be finalized within 90 days, all of them. Of course, then the decision that is usually not contested is the decision that grants the refugee status once it's taken at the first instance by the RLTO. So because there's no contestation, it's a positive decision. It can be within 2 days of the application after we have started the period of adjudicating the claim. Then the other question relates to cases of people who around December who will not mind to go to Mandela because then they go home. We are aware of that, but I don't think in these amendments we did pay attention to how we deal with that. But in terms of our operations at the centers, we limit finalization of cases around this period so that we don't put additional burden to the sisters, because we know that there are people notorious or nationalities notorious for coming to the center so that then they can be processed to Mandela. So we usually don't process many decisions around November, early December, and we then start focusing on our reports and other areas of administration, and we tend to intensify the decision making around January so that we don't put pressure unnecessarily. The period where there's also an abuse of returning people back to their country by our state corpus. It is not provided for, it is just an innovation that comes from within our side of administration. Then the last one, the longest period that I will attend to, the longest period for a refugee status. Once you are granted the refugee status, you are given a initial four-year period. However, within that 4 years, if the circumstances, because as part of the refugee protection regime, we generate reports in relation to specific circumstances, political circumstances of the countries that are giving us refugees. If circumstances in that particular country changes, we then consider a process of reviewing the decision. It can be done within that 4 years, but what we do, we align our review closer to the end of the 4 years so that we can determine whether you will be getting an additional 4 years, or if circumstances in your country of origin has changed, and therefore we then wish to start a process of reviewing with an intention to withdraw the refugee status. So it's an initial 4 years in Ansari that is informed by reviews that are informed by the research work that we do in relation to the claim that you would have submitted in from a particular country of origin.
Chair, if I may proceed on some of the other questions then as well. The issue about biometrics, Honourable Hatton, we did say that it's a bit that's been answered. Just on the issue about whether or not the Centre for Constitutional Rights there, yes, we took into consideration all the, and this is the document that was there initially, so we looked at all these inputs, Chairperson, and we also shared that with the state law advisors, all our, as has been indicated here. So we looked at all of that, and we applied our minds to all of that, indeed. Chair, then on the issue about other acts or laws that you indicated, and how do the asylum seekers, when asylum seekers arrive at refugee receptions, there are NGOs, etc., that are also applicable, and also engagement with the department to indicate, listen, in terms of assistance that you might need as a destitute child, or whatever the case may be, there's social development, we engage with social development in order to assist in this regard, because the legislation pertaining to those specific issues falls under the ambit of social development. You've also got the Marriage Act, for instance, which touches on your other issue about the Islamic marriages. Now, if I can take Chairperson to page 3, where we define the marriage and what it means in terms of South African law. Obviously, marriage in terms of the Marriage Act, the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act, also the Civil Union Act, which forms part of our legislative mandate. And you'll see that we delete, and then we say a marriage concluded in terms of the laws of a foreign country. So obviously, if a person comes and says, I was married in terms of Islamic law, etc., in that country, one would have to look at what are the specific provisions and that needs to be complied with in terms of that specific country for that marriage to be a legal marriage. And if we then accept that, or if it was a legal marriage in that country, we would then accept that in terms of the provisions of our legislation as marriage has been defined in the bill now. Chair, that is how far, those are the things that I'm not, I don't know if there are any other comments, so those are the ones I noted down, and I think I've responded to all of them. Thanks, Chair.
The issue of people who can't feed themselves, Chair, has been the subject of ongoing discussions with the UNHCR. As we understand or envisage how this process of screening people will happen, is they will come into the refugee center. We will investigate whether they are able to sustain themselves for a period of 4 months, either through friends and family, as you've seen in the bill. But if it is apparent that somebody simply cannot cope, like needs assistance immediately, the UNHCR in this country, not in other countries, but in this country, funds various NGOs who provide shelter and accommodation and food, etc. We are working out a program with them to enable us, when we come across such persons, to be able to transfer them immediately from the refugee center to such shelter where they would find basic needs taken care of. We are still in the process of discussing the mechanics of that, but that's how we think the situation should be handled. Chair.
You want to come? Okay, no, thank you very much. I wanted to do a follow-up exactly on that one, that it also relates to the other existing laws, that there is always, there are NGOs. My question is that, is it always, are they always there? Is it an arrangement?
I don't know how to put this question, that this function of them making no other laws and regulations others is done by NGOs because they are always there. It's law that they must be there. It relates also on the issue of food. Sitting here, if that is not the arrangement, my question would be, what if they are not there? Then what happens? If it is not compulsory that they are there. I just want to give Honorable Zwane, then you'll come in there.
Thank you. Chairperson, I just want to know, the children of refugee seekers born in South Africa, do they then get entitled to South African citizenship?
So I was saying, the more questions are asked, the more it gets. Get more questions. Honorable Pambo, I think you're taking the questions, not only the DM. Honorable Pambo Swobana.
Honorable, thank you, Honorable Chair. I just want to know if there are any refugees who would desperately need a chronic disease medication to do in that case. With all the processes that are due to happen, do you cater for them? We don't cater for them.
Yeah, I just want to add also that I was thinking as you were talking about, I agree with you that in other countries, Islamic marriages are recognized. I was thinking of a situation, they get married here in South Africa using Islamic law. Recognized or not recognized, they relocate to another country which does not recognize Islamic marriage. There's a problem in that country. Now they are citizens there. They come back to South Africa. The country where they are coming from, the marriage is not recognized. Where they got married initially, which is South Africa, is not recognized. So what will happen? Let's assume it was the country which does not recognize. It happens that they are Muslims. They use their Islamic marriage laws. Now there's a problem in this country. They come here. What happens? Do we use civil marriages or what do we use?
That one of the proposals which we have is to come up with what we call a refugee processing center. You remember now that we've already got a land in Limpopo. And to say, how is going to operate is that people are coming from, we will look at people as they come there, and then it will have a facility even to accommodate people and say, you are from a low-risk area, and when you come from a low-risk area, then all the way that is going to be built is that UNHCR is going to be there, Red Cross is going to be there, SCRA is going to be there, RAP is going to be there, every relevant bodies will be there, so that we shortened the period of coming to a decision. Because what raises these problems is the system we currently have, that you come because of the capacity in SCRA and RAP, you can be in the country for 3 years, which caused that issue to say people now must work because they can't sustain themselves. But once now we build those, it removes even that possibility. Then again, I will be able to identify now and say, yes, this particular individual, they won't be me. In fact, we're even saying, if you look at what is the damage which is caused by that people come and complain and says everybody's opening businesses in township, they are working, and all that based on that. We're even saying as a state, if now I was paying, that's why we at one point we approached National Treasury and say,
If now we're looking at those vulnerable groups like that, and you say, if in the social grant I am paying so much amount, to avoid that damage, if I'm able to say to this person who can't sustain, if you do that, it's far much cheaper than the damage which it causes if you don't give that provision. But again, we're saying now the UNHCR, why they can't take that responsibility, that the system is what will help us to be able to, because the key thing is that we must be able to deal with these cases within a shorter space of time. Because if you do that, then it removes all these other problems. Because if you don't, then it creates that. So that's why I was saying the system will be based on something like that. And then, yes, okay, this issue of the children. I think the Citizenship Act is also clear. We'll try to explain this. And say our Citizenship Act says, if a parent, one of the parents are South African, that child is a South African. But if it is not, during that time when that person is a refugee, that child follows the status of the parent. So we have said already that if you are a refugee, the only right you do not have is the right to vote. Because by its nature, the issue of a refugee is not a permanent. So we are saying you are here for 4 years. Ultimately, the intention is for you to go back to your country, one peace in those countries. Hence, as South Africa will be participating in those peace processes. So within that 4 years, when that parent is got a refugee status, that child has got the right to education, right to shelter, right to health, and right to everything. But once now the parent status changes, then that child will go back to the country. But once that child now attains age 18 years and has never gone back to the country, has got a choice to say, yes, I want to take the citizenship of South Africa or whatever, and then all that will be moved at that point.
Chairperson, just on the issue about the chronic medication that was raised as well, obviously what you're saying, that you've got the Bill of Rights in the Constitution and that everybody has the right to basic health care, education, etc. But this also goes into the realm of the Department of Health. They've got certain processes and procedures, and this is where the interaction would most probably then take place, where people would have to be referred. If there's a child that's in need of chronic medication, etc., it would be dealt with under that specific instances. Chair, also, just on your question about the marriage, I hear what you're saying, and one of the things we say, you can't legislate for each and every circumstance that could provide itself. But what one could say in this regard, should that ever arise, that person still, in terms of the current legislation, can apply in own right. It's still there. So whether or not the marriage, that person can apply in own right and indicate the circumstances, etc. Then you've also got the Civil Union Act in South Africa. Now, the Civil Union Act is not only for same-sex marriages. It's also for parties where people want to get married, but they don't want to be married under the Marriage Act, for instance. It would be, then they can do it under the Civil Union Act as well. There is provision for that that is made there, that so that people can get married in that regard as well. So, thanks, Chair.
Chairperson, I was actually looking at the clause that deals with vulnerable applicants. People who are coming from war-torn countries, some will really be vulnerable. And I'm just thinking, as we are debating that, in terms of human rights bodies, of which we are a member state too, It might not be as simple as to say we'll refer them to NGOs. We can end up with a situation where their rights are seriously violated. So I think at an implementation level, we might need technical teams to look very carefully. Remember, refugees are overseen by the United Nations. and all countries are under scrutiny as to how we look well after them. Not only vulnerability during the assessment phase, but in terms of them as residents in the country. I know from social development, it's just that they haven't been calling regular meetings. Even those who are disabled, it's a big issue for them as to how do we care for them while they're in South Africa. So I'm not sure whether we assume it will be taken care of, I don't know, it's something very delicate in the sense that also we cannot create the 5 stars for them while the majority of South Africans don't have those facilities. But at the same time, there's an expectation. There was reference to some submissions by these high-level human rights bodies. We just have to, on finalization, look very carefully at that and what we are saying in our own bill about vulnerable members.
Thank you very much, Honourable Minister. I'm surprised the NGOs did not raise that. I've not seen it. I might have missed it. That's exactly what I was asking, questioning, because we don't have control over the NGOs. We cannot, as government, just say the NGOs will do that, as if it's a law that says that we cannot do it as government. I like the idea of the refugees processing center. It makes sense to me. It makes sense to me, but it's not written anywhere. It doesn't appear anywhere. Whether we do it today or tomorrow, but at least it does show that we are trying to do something about it. I have a problem to have to say the NGOs will do it, yet we don't have control over them as government. But the last thing I want to say, I'm closing all members unless there is another matter. The one thing I also want, which I'm not sure of, is relationship between yourselves and Department of Health and Social Development. The Department of Health is under severe constraint, precisely because not only limited to this one, it's one of the matters. A number of just from Free State, from KZN, we've been to Mpumalanga. We are bordering different countries. Because these people come and you process them, whatever happens there. Let's say they are sick. Definitely they go to Department of Health. Do they know what to expect? At least they won't know, even yourself won't know how many people you expect. But at least the estimate. It means to me there is a need for the improved relationship between the relevant departments. It may not be related to the two. I'm just mentioning them because they're part of this committee. Education as well. They will go to Swaziland, they come and go to, go to school in Mpumalanga, go back home, Mozambique, same story. So it means it does not end with this department only. I don't know what to recommend, but something must be done about that. It gives serious pressure on other departments. And we have to comply and make sure that they do have education, they do have health facilities or access to health, and also issues of social development. You just mentioned the issues of disability, people with disabilities. All members, we got to vote. Presentations were made. We've engaged with the submissions. I will ask somebody who most or supports the bill. Honorable Zan.
Thank you, Chairperson. I move that we support the bill as Select Committee for Social Services. Thank you, Chair.
Mover, can I have a... Do we have to have all members voting? Yeah. Okay. Can we vote? least a simple one, this one. Members, who supports the bill? I don't see Kaula. Are you abstaining? Okay. No, thank you very much. Thank you very much, all members, all honourable members. All members of the committee do support the bill with the amendments we are finalising, but we're taking them. They will take them back to the portfolio committee, whatever we've changed here, but it will not come back to us. I'm asked to read a report. A report of the Select Committee on Social Services on the Refugees Amendment Bill, Bill 12B of 2016, National Assembly, Section 75, date 12 September 2017. The Select Committee on Social Services, having considered the subject of the Refugees Amendment Bill, Bill 12B of 2016, National Assembly, Section 75, referred to it, reports that it has agreed to the bill with amendments. I think this is what I just said now. Thank you very much, honourable members. At least we are done from our side. We are hoping that it will not come back. If it does, me and the legal advisors were in for a big fight. Because I asked them so many times about this. Thank you very much. Then we'll take a presentation on the briefing. Also to say, honourable members, this is not the first briefing. We had a pre-briefing. If I could, of a border management authority. If we can take that briefing, just to remind ourselves again, it's not the final, we're just getting a briefing formally now. It will be advertised. We're going to give it 4 weeks to be safe. And we'll come back and do exactly what we've been doing with the Refugees Amendment Bill and debate on it. I don't know who is, can I give it back to the minister again? Just to open it. We are planning the latest to finish by 12:30. The break. Okay, while the bathroom, there's a proposal for a bathroom. Can I say members who want to help themselves do that? Let's have a working bathroom session. I don't know. Okay, let's take 5 minutes break.
A recording device. Oh, it's important for us to know. is Ms. Elsie Lamini. Yeah, written here. I see you're spending a lot of time with this, the bills. But anyway, you are lawyers, so
nowadays,
yeah. From time to time, you come here, no?
Yeah. I mean, to assist.
I think we should start. We do not have much time. In fact, we don't have time. Not much is another thing. We don't have time. Can we start with the presentation? I will allow the Honourable Minister to open the presentation. As said, this is not the first presentation. We had a pre-presentation, but that was not formal because it was not yet officially referred to us. But can we allow the department to take us through with the understanding that we're still going to have an opportunity to interact with it?
Thank you very much, Chairperson, honorable members. Without really taking even a second, I just want to thank honorable members because this issue of border management is of utmost importance for the country. If you look at the trends all over the world, there's too much migration of goods and people. And so while yesterday Mandela would have said, let's lower the borders, but today there's a sense of urgency as to how do we ensure that we allow people in a legal and orderly manner in ways which protect them as well and protect us as government to be seen to be not to be allowing a chaos whereby the country absorbs more than what it can carry. So this is a very, very important bill, honorable members. Hopefully within our processes it will move to a point where we implement relevant clauses in achieving the desired objectives of securing our borders and allowing people in a secure and orderly manner and minimize all the risks and threats that goes with the borders that are not secured. Thank you very much, Chair.
Then, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, and Minister and Deputy Minister, I'll be making the presentation on the BMA. And as Chair, we have indicated that we had an interaction in March on this presentation. And then there were questions which were sent to us, and we responded on them on the 27th of March. I hope the committee members have got those responses. If they don't, we can still circulate them.
Let me check with members. Members, did we receive the responses on the questions we asked? They may still be relevant because the same presentation, instead of us starting afresh and asking you questions, I want to say, let's have the presentation, then you speak to the questions, as well speak to the questions, without really going to detail, just talk to the presentation.
Chair?
Honorable Hutton?
Before we start with the presentation, I see the presentation is marked confidential. I don't believe that can be so. Is that a, why should it be marked confidential?
Why is the bill marked confidential?
No, Chair, we can remove the. I think it's a time that we were presenting it. It was the same presentation. Remember at that time, the issue was we mustn't take it as we are presenting to the committee. It must just be just an arrangement. So I think it's about this project is exactly the same. We didn't change anything. So it's just to take out the presentation.
Okay.
Okay.
You don't have a copy. I brought my old one.
Really is to, as we said, just to give an overview on the Border Management Authority Bill as approved by the Tofono Committee on Home Affairs. So, Chair, I'm not going to go into details, but as we said, but it's just for the committee to consider for public support. So I'm not going to go into details. But having said that, I think it's important to just give the context on global border management in terms of that it is a problem worldwide. I will skip that. And then just say what are these main issues which we are looking at, issues of migration flows, state of the infrastructure into the border posts, and the natural resource belts, what are the diseases, hotspots, and the piracy areas. And then we're saying now, then this has been increasing over the years. The next slide is just to say what is the architecture of the border structure in South Africa. That we've got 53 land borders, 6 rail, 10 air borders, and maritime 9. Slide 7. And seven which gives us 72 ports of entry in total. And Chair, we go and say, what are the vulnerables in the border and environment? We say South Africa is an extensive border environment, land, air, and maritime. In terms of air, we've got 1.2 million kilometers square airspace. And then in terms of the land border, it's 4,471 kilometers. So when you think about how do you manage that borderline of that size, and then in terms of maritime, we've got 3.924 kilometers, and we are sharing borders with six neighboring countries. Then in the next slide, which is slide number 9, we just highlight what are some of the challenges which we have with regard to the air and the sea and the land. So I don't want to repeat it that the important part is that we've got a history and a failure of fragmented border management in South Africa. So we trace it from 1994 when it was really at that point, prior that, it was a militarized process. And then after 1994, we demilitarized it. And even the soldiers which were in the borders were recalled back. The fences which were there, all of them have fallen apart. And because the understanding was that we don't have enemies in South Africa. So even if you take police back, it's a right way. But now we've learned that in a difficult way. Hence, you know, around 2013, then the cabinet you know, took the decision to establish the border management. But I will go back to a history of it. The next slide, which is number 12, it deals really with the key features of a fragmented border management approach. As I had Chair, that will be visiting border That's what we're going to see. If they just go to the number two, lack of a single management command and control structure in any border environment. If there is a problem currently, is one will respond and say it's Home Affairs, another one is SARS, another one is police. It just goes like that. But in the end, the security of the country is at risk. So I just want to highlight that. And then we, on slide number 13, again, we are emphasizing here what are the consequences of the above fragmentation. Is that there is no non-aligned and often poor border control related service delivery. I want to, again, the corruption which is there, the issues of high volume of illegal goods entering in the country, and still, silence with agencies focusing on their own mandate. People, they feel good if they stand and say, oh, no, my organization is like this, the one which is bad is this one. Don't you ask and say, but what about the country? So that's still looking at the individual. Then, Chair, it's important now to trace what has been the political mandate and principles informing the BMAP. As 2009, as far as 2009, in the State of Nation Address, President Jacob Zuma stated that government will start the process of setting up a border management agency in South Africa. So there was difficulties, and then by 2013, again, then now cabinet, is then that the decision was taken at cabinet level to establish a PMA that will include the splitting of functions from relevant organs of state. I think that point is very important, because what we are looking at is an integrated border management. So we can't achieve that without splitting the functions. And then Department of Home Affairs was designated as the lead department. Then in December 2014, the cabinet approved the PMA vision and what would be the key priorities for transitional period, and that the PMA should be established by December 2016, which were passed. And then in 2015, cabinet endorsed that the draft BMA bill should be introduced to parliament. What have been these principles now informing the BMA bill? Is that BMA will be outcomes based, balancing facilitation of legitimate trade, travel functions, while simultaneously addressing security risks. So we don't want to see what's corruptizing the border management. We have got an understanding that it must have a balance between facilitation of the legitimate trade, tourism in terms of travel functions, whilst is looking at security risk. BMA will be established as a single implementation agency under a single executive authority, constituted as a single accounting authority, and then established by an enabling act, because before, we're working on gentlemen's latest agreement, which didn't work. So now it needs to, that's why we are here, is to come up with that legislative process. Then PMA will assume control of all ports of entry and borderline. That is very important. The border environment, you'll be looking at one entity. What are the functions and port of entry functions? Is immigration control, customs control, human health inspection, biosecurity, inspection of animals, fish and associated foodstuffs and products, inspections of plants and related products, border policy, and full custodianship for infrastructure and land borders. Let me emphasize that, because that's one of the biggest problems we had. That when you go to a border environment, at a land border, currently it's public works. When you go to the maritime environment, it's the Port Authority, TMPA. And then when you go to air, it's AXA. But with that, though we are operating there, AXA, whether they give us a space or not, we have to go and beg them to say, can you give us a space, instead of being the other way around, to say, for you to have this license, you must provide us with enough space. I mean, here in Cape Town Harbor, for many, many years. We were operating here in town. People would move and come here, they get lost in between. And then we had to go and get a space there. But we're paying rent. We are paying rent to TNPA to be in that environment. But for them to have those goods and all that, they depend on us. So that was one of the important issues. You have to look at it. Then in the maritime environment, we'll have now a Coast Guard which will patrol to the extent of exclusive economic zone. What we're saying here is that between us and defense will take beyond the exclusive economic zone, and then BMA will start from that coming next to the shore. So that we make sure that we guard our Coast Guard. But at the moment, nobody's looking after it. If we get stories around about Port St. John's that these big vessels will stop there in the high seas, and then the small boats are taking goods and bring them into our country from that, but who's monitoring? So that's why now you need the Coast Guard. It's the same with the land border. Yes, defense is there, but now once the BMA now is established, because what we want to see in the border environment is one uniform. We don't want to see this uniform and that's reporting to that one. So within the 10 kilometer to the border line, then that's where the BMA border guard will work. However, we need to emphasize that does not take the responsibility of police. If there is a police station there, it will still remain, because police are dealing with issues of crime, which are not related to the border issues. But the border guard will be dealing with crime, which is related to issues of border environment. That's why now in the bill we explain what is a border law enforcement, how do we separate that. Chair, the one of a border which was asked even in the questions was that one was still remain with the South African Defence Force to deal with the airspace. Then the other one was that BMA will be established as a command and control organization with complete the airspace. That one is remaining with the defense. They are still managing that. It is not transferred to BMA. That's what defense will deal with. BMA will be established as a command and control organization with complete management authority with all ports of entry and border law enforcement areas. So we always emphasize that. Then we're saying that a basket of border law enforcement functions will be ceded or transferred from relevant organs of state. BMA will be established on the basis of primary frontline integration of border law enforcement functions at ports of entry and border law enforcement areas, as we have explained. But the other key phenomenon of the BMA will have what we call the National Border Risk Management and Targeting Center. It's not intelligence in the true sense, but we have the capability, because we can't operate in that environment without able to have that capacity. Because if you don't, you are functioning with some goods like that. Then we said it will establish its own organizational culture. The BMA will now assume operational responsibility for port of entry infrastructure and maintenance. So that is a key important we're taking from the Department of Public Works. However, AXA and TNPA will still be responsible for that, but the law makes the provision for them not to give us as they like. It's going to be a must in terms of the act, that this is what we need at this area, it must be like this, and then they will be compelled by law to do that. So what is important here is that the new paradigm shift of integrated border management, so that is a very, very important part of this. That's why in all
very slow today, I don't know why.
Yeah.
You lost me.
Yeah.
I don't know whether I'm the only one who's lost.
I'm slow.
What slide are you? It's me who's slow.
Oh, I'm in slide number 18. Maybe I'm pushing very fast.
Oh, no, I was fast. Okay.
No, when we have already in front.
Okay. I think this time there is
So I mean, 18 and 19 is just to explain what is the vision of the base, just summarizing that to say we'll have a border guard, we'll have an armed border management, and then it will be responsible for all ports of entry. The key thing again, single command and control authority in the border government. Yes, it will be implementing over 40 laws currently which we have, and then also we'll have approximately about 9,000 public servants which are already there. Chair, this is a process now on slide number 21, just to see how the process has been followed, so that we make sure that the NCOP understand that we have followed all the processes, that the bill was approved by Cabinet to be introduced to Parliament. We did go to the public service sectoral bargaining chamber, that is for employees, and then we had engagements at NEDLAC, because this affects the economy of the country, and then we had bilateral meetings with the unions and the business, and as a process, we had to get consultations and inputs from the Office of the State Law Advisor in order to make sure that the bill does meet the constitutional muster. So then on slide 22, we are seeing then the issues of constitutional concern have been addressed, and then some substantive have been revised, structure and outline of the bill has been revised, and minor drafting matters have been addressed. Overall, Cabinet approved policy direction and outcomes remain unchanged. So just to highlight three issues which we had at when we were at NEDLAC, that there were only three issues which we had then. One was that the Labour had an issue about establishing of agencies. They were viewing as we are agentizing government. Why the government can't just perform these functions instead of having an agency. But again, the compromise which we have there was to say, fine, it's not an agency, because people have got this thinking that we are outsourcing. It's not. It's a, when we agree not to be a border management authority, that's why it changed from an agency to an authority. And then the other issues here, anyway, was not related to BMA as such, was the issue of the security vetting. There was the issue of delays in the security vetting of the employees is affecting government as a whole. Even on this one, whether BMA doesn't have that full mandate. It means now you employ employees, they work for 24 months, and they understand that you bring as the vetting certificate. What if you say is negative? What that employee must do when he's been employed for 24 months? So it's something which government, we did bring it to the attention of government, they are working on it. Then the other issue which was raised was the matter of routine searches. What the law is giving power to the border guard is to say, yes, they can have routine searches. If now you get into an airport, they can look at this person and stop and say, let me open this bag. Because if you look at what has been happening in this airport, in this terrorist attacks, is that in other countries, for that matter, an airport is a secured area. Once you get in there, it must be clear that you've got a ticket and you are traveling to somewhere. You can't go to the airport and say, I'm coming to sit in a restaurant there for what? Because it's what causes people now to attack countries. So we want you now to empower the so business at the issue with that, but we agree to say is something which we need. So those were the three issues which were raised. Well, in terms of parliamentary process, as I said, when the bill was introduced to Parliament, and then when the portfolio committee worked on it, yes, there were some changes in the bill. So the one now which is presented here is already taken into account, those changes in 3 up to K. And then it was approved in March, and then only have voted in June 27 and abducted to be presented to the NCOT. So that's what Chair. Chair, as we said now that in the bill on slide 28, I don't think we need to, as I said, that one we did in detail in that meeting. It's just to say this is what the chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3, and we did get into detail in the previous meeting. So I will try not to deal with those lights which are dealing with that, because I can save time so that I can also deal with the questions. But if there are questions from the members, I can come back to it. But basically, what is on the slide, it's just to explain what are the intended benefits of the BMA. It's the creation of a customer service efficiencies through streamlined integrated operations at the ports of entry. That's why, Chair, we always explain this matter that by taking customs in the border post does not attach the issues of revenue. It's only the front line operations, as we said, customs, but without the issues of then we're saying that a formalized between the BMA and relevant organizations to enhance security and management of the border environment, improvement in shared information, risk profiling, that's what I was talking about, the National Targeting Center, and mitigation and enforcement to create integrated border environment picture. A focused approach to the optimization of port of entry operations and processes to enhance efficiencies through maximum compliance and minimum administrative costs and delays. And we see it that there will be effective utilization of financial, human, infrastructure, and accommodation resources. For instance, now at OR Tambo, as an example, Home Affairs has got a staff of about 200 and 300, that's what we have. Whereas police has got about 800. That's why when we're at OR Tambo, we see police visible everywhere. But Home Affairs doesn't have that capacity. So once now we are one entity, we can be able now to take all those resources and be able to utilize improve sterility and integrity of port of entry. That's what I was talking about. So say now our ports of entry must not be the issue. That I mean, if you go to Bainbridge as an example, that you find that there are shops just in the line, and then the gates, people are just coming in and out as if it is a park, but it's not a park. That is a security area. We say, you know, then it will make improvement in the management, discipline, and transparency, the single line of sight of authority at the port of entry. So I tried to rush, and then now, if I can go now, as I said, that there were questions which were asked, and then we submitted them. So what I would just say that the questions which were asked, question number one, there are many unofficial and informal places of entry and exit along South African land border. How will the BMA address these challenges? Yes, as we know that the borders were imposed to us, and then some of those borders are just splitting tribes, uncle is the chief on one side, and another one is the chief on the other side, and all what we're talking about. So that is something which we understand. Hence, we already started informal border crossing, but when we say informal, that people are using, we capture the fingerprints of people from both sides, and there is the immigration. Well, they don't use a passport, but at least we are using the fingerprint to know who is this person who is crossing, so that they don't go to long distance. And now we are busy with one now at the border next to is another one where we are piloting this. So we are mindful of those problems. Then the other question was, it is noted the effectiveness of the monitoring system in the monitoring ships and other maritime vessels at sea is influenced by the transponders on the vessels. How will BMA address the challenge of transponders being turned off by vessels, making them undetectable? Yes, it's as a fact. So we're responding here to say yes, we'll be working with the Department of Agriculture, because that's what they are responsible for. However, once now you've got those coast guards, that's what now will be helping us to look at that, to say that this ship was coming somewhere, then it gets lost. When it is somewhere, then you send your coast guards to go and check what that ship is, and then you will be building the systems as we go forward. Then the other one was that BMA proposes to bring together the functions of human and goods movement in the border environment. However, this will have the results of fragmenting SARS functions and tax collection. How will BMA address corruption and revenue collection when the customs functions transfer to BMA? So the first thing which was saying is that there's no organization which is immune from the issues of corruption. That's why we needed now to have this integrated approach. Because if we can get the stories which are happening on these boats, because if now you are a player and a referee, there is a challenge. Like now, if you take customs, customs are coming with that goods come from country A. And then everything is cleared when that goods are in that particular country. But by the time they come into the border, now we have a split. Because another organization have to be able to look at this, because this work on a risk profile. If now SARS, as an example, is in fact that's what we're gathering, that they are able for now to inspect about 10% of our cargo. And then now we say, if now that is happening, then you ask yourself a question and say, where are we sitting with these issues now for illicit goods, drugs, and all that? But if now you've got that, you get an ability of another organization, you get now to check this and say, oh, we have done that, and this is what they do. But because we're targeting certain countries, one, you'll be able now to get that. But as I've explained that, but not the issue of now taking the revenue in that process. But what we want you to do is that you manage this thing seamlessly in the proper fashion. And then, I think we have explained even on the next page of this document. Okay, the other question was, what capacity exists in the department to oversee the BMA? No, this will be a new organization, and it's not the capacity in the Department of Home Affairs, the capacity in all the departments which are currently in the border environment. That staff will be transferred to the public entity, and then so we're not going to start from scratch. And as we know that one principle in government, that the shift of functions, funds follows that. Once a decision is taken that this function is moved to BMA, every department will have to cede that function. Hence, you know, the proposal was to establish a BMA as a public entity instead of a government. Are there similar border management entities globally? Yes. And it was a start which we told, which we have done. Other people went to Europe, others Asia, others Americas, and look at what are the other agencies which are look like this. So we have done that. But in Africa, there is no one at the moment. So what Africa has is a one-stop border, a type of a border management, but not a border management agencies. Other similar entities exist in government that are not performing well. Why would the BMA be different? As Chair, I said that this depends really in the management to say the BMA has got clear vision, what it wants to achieve, and then it will be covered by legislation. So we don't want to, and it's not the entity which will outsource. It will just be able to, so it will be really be based on the management and monitoring which we need to have. I think this question was asked, why is airspace excluded from BA's mandate? There are many small air trips that are not supervised. So we explained here that SNDF was decided now that they are still dealing with the airspace as a whole, but they understand that that airspace includes those small air trips which they have to do. Are the 9,000 envisaged BM staff enough? Part of the border guard's responsibility will be to patrol the entire land borderline and the unofficial border crossing. Yes, it is not enough. As we know now that the defense has got only about 15 companies to, as I said, now if you look at that stretch of the borderline, which is 4,400 and something, so it is not enough. But it will be built in the budget proposal which we have submitted to Treasury over 3 years, because currently we are estimating that we've got about 3.8 billion rand, which is sitting on various departments. But over a period of 3 to 5 years, we are looking at something like 10 billion rand in order to fund PMA fully. Because we're seeing now currently it was not funded fully. That's why there are problems, but the pockets are here and there. But we'll be able to start with what we have. I think, Chair, those were the questions which were asked, but again, we have responded to them, and we can send the questions. Sorry, Chair, maybe I've rushed too much because of...
No, thank you very much, DG. All members, here is the presentation. If we feel that we still want to ask other questions, but also taking into consideration, though it was not a fully fledged oversight, because DG, Minister, we were in KZN last week doing our oversight. If we were to do oversight, we write to all departments that we will be going to this province. At least if politicians could not be available, let them send senior officials to respond to issues, because in some issues we'll want the department to commit. It did not happen. But also some of the challenges that you're talking about, we observe them even though we did not engage. For example, on the, we were told how many maritime ports of entry have, but you still have about 70 in the fishing ones where they are not controlled, informal. No answers on those. And the question, how do we control those? But also the question of goods. I'm waiting for members to raise their hands while I'm talking. Those who want to add questions. The issue of goods. When we were busy with the xenophobia, there was an ad hoc committee on xenophobia. We went to one of the cities that we visited. It was Durban, eThekwini. There was a no-go area for South Africans. Very interesting. It was controlled. It's not only Durban, also in Joburg. Controlled in Durban, it's about three streets fully controlled by foreign nationals. Some it was Nigerians, some it was it Pakistan, some it was there in those streets. There are so many containers, which was a source of the conflict. You may see it as a small problem, it's a serious problem. The source of conflict was that South African small businesses are saying we are not able to compete with them. And it's true, because they are getting goods direct from the ship to their businesses very cheap, and South Africans don't have access on that, to that. And when we asked them how do these containers come here, you could see that it was illegal. We asked them now when we're there. That guy was saying there are companies that which we exempted because of their long standing in business. We don't check them. Sometimes people use them to smuggle their things, but also they can only take goods where they have agreed with companies. For example, let's say Adidas. Say if Adidas said, if you see our counterfeit goods, arrest. What about those who did not? It's not a small problem. It's a huge problem. So, honorable members, I don't know if you want to add. I'm just raising few issues, adding few issues, or we will come back to it when we debate after the inputs from the stakeholders. Honorable Kaula.
Well, thanks, Chair. Like, I think there are areas of concern that the department has to pay attention to. One other area that the harbour in Durban highlighted to us was the increased challenge of stowaways, which is causing a huge problem. They are saying because of being short-staffed, what they reported to us, when I asked later on Chair at the meeting, they say what they reported us may be very few of the exact number of the stowaways that get into the country. Now, the challenge is because they have got very few people, and that they are not able to catch whoever comes unlawfully as a stowaway. So that is one other area which is very, very critical, the issue of staffing. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Let me welcome the presentation and appreciate the fact that over the radio I've heard the minister was a bad bridge. I just wanted to check, Chairperson, whether the issues that we have raised during the oversight that we did last year, how far are they with the improvements that we've had? Bad bridges, do you remember where they?
Ngombuzo esengathi comment ku presentation ka DG malungana le area yase Port Central esumkhambane ba uyaphawula ulangeni akukho monitoring eyenzekayo kungena wena kuphuma wena ukukwenkulu ungena uphuma nokhozo there is no monitoring eyenzekayo kwelacala mhlawumbi le DMA assist that in a way that I love as a thank you because the Guavula teacher in Gaska in that job is areas he forecast is a East London but when you come to in the area of the East Pondoland yomkhambathi yotshone mzamba akho movement eyenzekayo that means ziyazingenela nayiphina into ofuna ukungena iyangena le DMA I think izawusincedisa kwela cala lendishase comment nje thank you.
Honorable Stock.
No, thank you very much. Honorable Chairperson, I would just want a question for the DG. In the presentation, the DG mentioned, I think it's in slide number 12 of the presentation, which deals with the key features of fragmented border management approach, where you spoke about all the challenges that are confronting the department in relation to the border management post and all of that. Where there's a problem, somebody will be shifting the responsibility or pointing a finger at the other official. So what the BMA seeks to achieve, I'm quite conversant about it. It seeks to integrate all the functions in one so that we have one common approach. But I've got one question that is in my mind, DG. When we are going to be integrating the functions of the different departments into one, into the BMA approach, common approach, or uniform approach, are you taking the same people? And if you are taking the same people and deploy them into this BMA function, what is the process that is going to unfold? Are you going to vet them? Or what is it that you're going to do? Because where I'm sitting, I'm a bit confused. If you take the same people and put them in the BMA, and then you change the uniform, and then you say, no, this is the uniform approach, and this is how we're going to handle issues. I've got a concern in my mind, because you might get the same results at the end of the day. It is the same approach. So I just needed clarity on that. Thanks, DJ.
Yeah, before you respond, DG, I just want to indicate again, emphasize that this is not about Department of Home Affairs. It is about the safety of the country. I think if you could just bear that in mind, you can't have a country that is better that thing is closer, but you can't have a country that is free for all. I'm starting from the airspace. Maybe members, we need a presentation from defense to say if we, let's say we close the land ports of entry, we close the maritime ports of entry, we still have over 200 informal airstrips. What will happen with them? We have not solved the problem. To partially solve the problem. It will be good for us to know what will happen with them. We may have to invite them to make a presentation. Maybe there is a good reason for that, why it's not included in this. That is, it will be creating for me the impression that people who are criminals or who are not desirable in the country are poor people, because people who are using those informal airstrips are people with money. Is that the impression that we are creating? We'll need to have a presentation on that one. It would also have been good for the committee if we had an opportunity. I don't know, from the portfolio committee, you may check with them if they're part of the tour around, to see what is happening in those countries that are implementing. Is it effective? Because it's good to take a decision on something that you know is going to work, as compared to those countries which are not using it. A country closer to African model, because we are saying as much as we want to close our borders, we don't want to forget about our history, how our people were divided into two, why we still have to, in a controlled way, have people who will go this side and come there. If there is a tour, was there a tour on a country or that is closer to Africa, African situation? Then we requested DG that an arrangement, because we had very little, not information, let me put that way, because of the size of our committee, we don't have time to go to everything, but at least we've got an idea what is happening inland and maybe airspace, because we use the flights of being outside and in, but on maritime, I think it was our first time to go to the Durban one. We had requested that let be an arrangement of an oversight so that we know what we're talking about. If there is a ship or whatever that is used there. You see, I'm talking about the airspace because we've been to flights, we've been through to those borders. We don't know what is happening in maritime. We can go there and watch and see, but we don't know. Physically, when you are in the port, how do people go in and out? We requested Minister, that was quite some time now, that let us be allowed time to do an oversight. We're told you have about 7 formal maritime airports, depending on the speed or whatever, we may not have crews from Cape Town to Durban. We may use crews somewhere, but somewhere use flights. So that I think it can be done in 2 or 3 days. I don't want us just to take a decision on something that we're really not sure, because the bill is urgent and we just do it. We are prioritizing it. I mean, we really prioritize the bill. But at the same time, it will be ignorant of the committee just to agree on something that we are not 100% sure on what we're agreeing upon. Okay, back to you, Minister and the DG.
No, thanks, Chair. You know, Chair, we really, we have been struggling with this bill because of the main challenge.
What are the concerns of, I know we will allow them space because already they've given us a submission of Treasury. In your understanding, what are the concerns of National Treasury?
No, thanks, Chair. As I'm saying, Chair, I was starting with that point to say what really we appreciate is that now there is a consensus on the challenges which we have. Because what was a difficulty was when people don't see these challenges, we talk like there is no problem. That's why you'll get people saying, why do we fix something which is not broken? And we have asked now a bit difficult to explain what is this thing which we see that it is broken. For instance, Chair, the issue of the goods which we have attached, remember I said this thing is in various entities, but it is not integrated. So maybe another entity will look at this thing in a particular perspective, not in the other. As we are asking the particular issue now is that the main issue which from the SARS perspective is that the goods are used in order to collect the tax. So if you look at the goods in that perspective, then everything is fine. But once you start changing it now and says, no, I'm fine about what we are collecting as a tax, but what about the issue of illicit goods? They are there. I mean, one of the issues we are raising and say, but where these drugs are coming from? Are we saying the drugs are manufactured in the country? Even if it is so, they are manufactured with what? There is a material cut, there is a machine to produce them. So anyway, there is a problem if that is the case. That's why we believe that you combine everything under Chair, if now you sit in a border like Beitbridge, you are there in a port of entry, just 2 kilometers from the port of entry, there's no fence there. Yeah, an example. People are crossing and all that. Now, if you ask Home Affairs, I'm not going to say, no, I'm putting the stamp on those who have come through, but I'm not interested on those. The ones I'm interested on are these ones who are crossing in the 2 kilometers. And defense will say, no, my priority is in a borderline next to Swaziland, not the one which is here. So that is the problem, to say the BMA must be able to solve the issue of integrity, so that when you go into that environment, you ask literally one person, why things are going wrong. Come to this issue, the Chair, of the, as I'm saying, people, when we twist it, this one that you can see, when people are fighting spaza shops, it's exactly based on that, to say, where do these goods come from? That's why here on page, I show it on page 6, and we say, where are the piracy areas? There, the one there, the top. But these goods, I said, in Port Johns, that's what I've mentioned. I said, in Port Johns, this thing stops in the high seas there, and the small boats are taking cement from those things and crossing. Now, when I'm running my shop, or the hardware shop, how am I going to compete when I buy my cement from the PCC company, but you get it from the law. That's what is happening. You know, he knows it's from Home Affairs. Must go and sort it out. So what we're saying is exactly that. To say, if we don't have this understanding, that's why now we're talking about the issues of infrastructure and say, why you are saying public works? Because if you go to a port of entry, a gate will not work for 12 months. 12 months. But when you ask the manager of Home Affairs or police or whatever, respond easily. You know, it's public works. But people are crossing here in front of you. And according to the laws, which is effect as well, you take money from Home Affairs, you fix that gate. From Water General, that is an irregular expenditure. So that's why now we're saying, I remember the argument we had with the unions in particular, to say, why do you want this thing to be a public entity? They said, no, the constraints which we have under government setup is that all the technology which we're talking about is dependent on CETA. If CETA doesn't give me the lines or whatever, there's nothing I can do. But the BMA will be able to consolidate that with the efficiencies and all that. So the no-go areas, we know about them. There is an interministerial committee on migration, which is chaired by the minister in the DPMB, Deputy Chair Minister of Home Affairs, which is tasked to deal with this intergovernmental, which now includes the provinces and the municipalities. So we had one meeting. Yeah. So we are working on those things where every block is there. So the no-go areas are in KZN, are in Gauteng, are in in Western Cape. So is to look at all those. So I check the issue of this, that to what we understand, the portfolio committee was on a visit in Germany, but I think it was postponed. They were not able to visit, but I think there was in their plans to go to one of the countries. That's where I understand. I don't think they ever managed to take that statutory. Stowaways, I mean, if we can go to that big point, I mean, if you take the one, the biggest one, let's forget the name, not the one in the one, Richards Bay. You go to Richards Bay, and you just look and say, where is the office of Home Affairs there? Where is it? It's somewhere where you can't control anything. But the Richards Bay port is making millions of rands, but they can't give us a space in the right location here in Cape Town. We're fighting there on this thing of the transponder. Because when the ships are going to arrive, they report into that tower. But to get information from the tower now to our center, we must go and beg. Why this thing can't be connected? Why must I go and get a paper to say, here is a ship arriving at 12, is having this and that, instead of sending that thing electronically? But you can't do it on a gentleman's ladies agreement. We have tried from 1994. That's why we need this act. That's why we need this act, so that we're able to do that. So that the issues of stowaway, we can be able to deal with them. Chairperson, when we say in Home Affairs, we've got 750 inspectorate officials throughout the country, as against Tshwane Metro Police. If you go to Tshwane, every robot there, you find the Metro Police next to the robot there. Looking like it turns green or red or what. But now we don't have that capacity. So in fact, with that 750, we're able to say in some areas, we don't even have one person, one. So that's where we are. But what we are doing with that, that's why now on our repositioning for Home Affairs, we are saying Home Affairs must be repositioning the cause as a security department, because if it is understood as an administrative department, that's how it's going to be funded. Then now Bait Bridge Minister was there, but there's a, yeah, in fact, the only thing we wanted to do with Bait Bridge, there is a project where we're looking at 6 ports of entry. The infrastructure must be revamped in a big way. But Bait Bridge as it stands, there's nothing more we can do with that infrastructure. We tried this, we tried that. That's why now the process is to improve that. We're already at a treasury approval one to look at how these 6 ports can be revamped with the state of the art. Once we get there, that's where we can resolve the Bait Bridge. And then now, Port St. Joseph, I think we've agreed. Remember, I mentioned it even before you asked. It was one of the areas. Yes, it will help at that. Honorable Stoff, what is going to happen with moving the team? Remember, I said one of the issues we didn't agree with the unions was the matter of vetting. That's why we were saying, no, there is no way. Even on this amendment, a bill, we are talking about the issue of the vetting of people in these areas can't be 5 years. It must be dependent on an issue, and as well as the polygraphy test must be like that. So yes, the people will be transferred, but after they've followed all those processes, if you don't meet that, then you remain where you are. If you meet, then you'll be able to come in. So, Chair, that's where we are. As we said, that we have responded to all the questions, but if there are others, we will be free to take them. But really, the issue which we are saying we are looking for is that integrated structure, which must be able to deal with these issues. Well, the National Treasury, I think I've touched on them. As I'm saying, the main issue, the way we understand it, is that Treasury's view is that if you separate the goods into the tax process, it will fragment at that. So in our view is that, no, even currently, those goods, the tax process started the country of origin and paid those things through EFT. By the time the goods are in the port, the same staff are just checking whether these goods are according to what was on the goods when they are taxed abroad, and then they come in here. So we believe that we can, as long as BME does not touch the revenue, we touch the goods, we'll be able to achieve.
Just to broadly respond to key questions. As I said earlier on, I think it's in the interest of all of us to find ways of ensuring that we move towards finalizing this legislation process so that we begin to understand what are we dealing with. There was a question, a comment from Chair and what Honourable Chair and Honourable Stock said, which I thought it really summarizes everything. Yeah. Our aspiration is to see an integrated, coordinated force in managing migration through our ports. But the reality of the problem is that there are historical decisions that everybody have to understand that for us to achieve, even at this point where we are, people will have to give away their identities. If you go to some of these, you'll find that the police still think that the police. the military will still think in that fashion. And so it really creates these loopholes where in the interim, sometimes the risks are through the hands of the police, sometimes through military, sometimes through our own officials. So ideally, we all know where we are supposed to go, but we cannot explain why are some of the things not being done today, even with limited capacity at our ports. Of course, there's the second point, which seems to be a major problem, is the capacity. For instance, if you have bases all over the port, wherever you go, you'll find that you find a Home Affairs person, even when you have gone through a point where you have been cleared. But in our case, you find that in some ports, there will be an area where we don't have sufficient, we are not covered. And so all those things at the moment, they create huge risks, because people who do not want to enter legally, they look for loopholes. So as long as we have obvious risks, people will capitalize on them, and we'll have the problems of these ports, bases which are controlled by foreigners in our country. If you see a problem in one port, there are similar practices all over the 72 ports of entry. When we say what difference will it make, as Honorable Stock was saying, if you go to these ports, you find that everybody will tell you that there are syndicates here who are controlling the port. And of course, we are there, whether we have a shortage of police, military, Home Affairs, we are all there. But these difficulties in intervening decisively and timelessly, they also become a loophole. Because, as long as syndicates are known, everybody will know what they are doing. They assist people to enter illegally through countries. And so those are some, I think as we look at this, even at the finalization stage, it might help a lot to get different committees to talk about the obvious that we're not doing today. Because we can't say they will change the mindset and do it the day we have the Border Management Authority. It's almost like a lot of work which must happen in people's minds. I mean, there are things, coordination is very, very important, but the question is, what will it take for people to cooperate and coordinate now? At Bay Bridge, you'll still see a goods train not stopping at the port when they are known circulating stories that people will install illicit drugs and all other dangerous things, even underneath the wheels and so on. So there are many things that in the process of finalizing work should be looked at as a matter of urgency, so that we minimize the risks that our people are exposed to. The maritime side, obviously, it's a major risk. I think from the time when the Border Management Authority Bill was conceptualized, we should have strengthened what now is the Interministerial Committee and other technical teams at an official level, because without those, it might take longer for our people to see the benefit of what we are trying to do. And also another area where, for me, I think we have to look at very carefully. There are things we won't achieve till such time that we strengthen cooperation through DECO with feeder countries. In areas where people succeed in managing their borders is where there are tough discussions between countries, those who are producing high numbers of migrants and the receiving ones. So that even in terms of securing the border, there's a commitment from both sides. Otherwise, there's no one country which can really successfully carry the burden if the other feeder country is just a bystander doing as little as they can. So the issue of border management authority bill is important, urgent, but it calls for real inter-ministerial, inter-departmental cooperation so that we don't solve one problem, then we move on to another next one. Solve another one, then we move on, so that we come up with the, we see impact, even in stages.
Mm.
Yeah.
No, thank you very much, Honourable Minister, EG and the team. Honourable members, I was just thinking that maybe to finalise, we'll have to set aside 2 days. We can still ask some questions later. But I do want to indicate, Honourable Minister, that it's a problem that, you know, bills take long in government before they come to Parliament. And it leaves us with very limited time to interact and engage. Because as I was saying earlier, it would have been ideal for us to understand what we are dealing with. Because the more you talk, for me, the more my mind opens that, oh, it's more business than anything other thing. Business is very highly involved. If you look at the goods that comes in, which Home Affairs has got nothing to do, as they were presenting in Durban, they were said, oh, we could have presented to you, but you just need to get it approval from our minister, you see. We can only get information about who comes through the border post, not the goods, because it's another department. It's a problem. You're not dealing with the problem. The whole issue of the entry to the country. So we would have needed more time to look at some of the issues, but also the exchange experience. I know the portfolio committee is going, I think if it's not November, it's December. If things go well according to the plan, we would have approved this bill. If we find some challenges in countries that are implementing already, we have already approved the bill. And for me, what is the use of going out if you have already finalized? What is the use of us before to go out, because we would have already finalized? But as I'm saying, if members agree, finalizing it, we cannot exhaust everything because we have our meetings, other meetings now. We can adjourn at this level, but hoping that when we finalize it, we'll create more time. Just talking about 2 days so that we can have these other stakeholders presenting to us that if we close here, how are you going to contribute to what we're doing here? The issue here, your funding, DG. You'll be an authority outside government. Okay, government authority, but most of organizations similar to this, they fund themselves. Okay, they get some money from government, but there is a portion where they make money. Maybe when we meet next time, you have to speak to that. How you going? If you say you are not talking about revenue, how are you going to fund yourself? Something that you must think about. Honourable members, thank you very much for your time. And the department, the meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
And then we have to make a clearance for you and me. So the capacity is you, okay. So in other words, we have to be flexible. You know what I mean? Yeah. Yeah.
You know the guys who work there?
Yeah.
All of them.
Are you on the
Thank you.